This is really good. This is really what I'm looking for. So, one thing you've mentioned that I'm real curious about is where have the Jewish students gone?
Well, some of them are still here. I don't know the numbers that are here, but it's really funny. There used to be a professor here named Keith Shillington, who's dead now, and he was a chemistry professor. And Shillington was one of the first Catholics who was hired on this campus. And Shillington used to tell stories about his interview here, and his religion came up in the interview, and somebody finally said, oh, well, you can't do much damage, you're just going to be teaching chemistry. But Shillington used to tell me, and he came here in the 50s, and I knew Shillington ever since I was a kid because I'm Catholic, and Shillington played the organ at our church, etc. Shillington used to tell me that school used to take a total, and I don't know whether this is true, but this would be what he would say. The school would take a total of 30 Catholics and Jews a year, and sometimes it might be 29 Jews and one Catholic, and the next year it might be opposite, or some years it might be 15 Catholics and 15 Jews. In any regard, during the 60s there were these two fraternities, and I don't know how many boys were in either house at the time. I'm sure the university had, well, you can look at calyxes, and you can see, you can count numbers, the CBT house and the Peep house, as it was called. What I suspect that you probably would find today is that a lot of the Jewish students have sort of disappeared into, or sort of assimilated, I guess would be a better word. But Richard Marx sort of heads up the Hillel for the campus, so there's a Jewish organization on the campus. Now, how many students are in that organization, I don't know. But I think they have an annual Passover Seder even, so there are some Jewish students still here. They just simply may not be as obvious as they used to be. There certainly are a lot more Catholics now. I think, I'm not really sure this, but I think that when you look at by denominations rather than religious groups, the largest denomination, I think, is Roman Catholic, with the Episcopal Church coming next, and Presbyterians, etc. But so those kinds of things have changed. But then, you know, times have changed very much too. And if, you know, just think of the kinds of suits that you'd have if there was religious discrimination, to say the least. But, you know, the admissions director is also a Catholic too. So, but. Washington used to recruit primarily in the South, and one of the Jewish students that I continue to have contact with, who is a good friend, is an attorney in Spartanburg, South Carolina, which is where he's from, a guy named Gary Polyakov, who was in the class of 73. And Gary was one of those first students who didn't belong to one of the Jewish fraternities. In fact, he belonged to the Pica House, which is right across from the First Baptist Church. But I think the Jewish students are certainly still around.
Because I don't have a strong sense of them, whereas people do talk about these Jewish fraternities and that it was a presence before, and I don't have a sense of a presence of them here.
No, well, I think you'd probably have to talk to Richard Marx and get some feel for what Hillel is all about today, and I think that's the only Jewish organization that's around. And certainly, you know, there aren't many adult Jews in the community. In fact, 2 years ago, we used to have a friend who lived here, who has since moved to Oregon, but she used to have parties at her house to celebrate Jewish feast days. And even though we were Catholics, we were close friends with her, and we'd get invited to these things. We also, in those days, had some sense for who the Jewish members of the community were, but anymore, when you go beyond Mali Pelichara and the Gruenwalds, I sort of have to scratch my head and try to think who they might be.
So, gradually the numbers of minority students began to grow?
Well, can we really say that the minority numbers have ever grown? You know, one of the things is yeah, Washington Lee has a hard time recruiting. And certainly there are reasons for Washington Lee having a hard time recruiting.
Why? Why do you think that is?
Well, one is certainly the Confederate, the image of the Confederacy. One of the things that black people have tended to be repulsed by is this whole romanticism of the Confederacy and the lost cause, because there's no reason for black people to romanticize the lost cause. My God, there were slaves during that glorious lost cause. On the other hand, this silly argument that goes on about the Confederate flag. I mean, one of the things that our students love to do is to display the Confederate flag, but one of the, and certainly you have recruits on campus and they see Confederate flags being used as curtains and dormitory windows, etc., it's a real turnoff. And why is that a turnoff? Well, the Southern student is going to argue that the Confederate flag is only a symbol of or an artifact of the war. Well, that's nonsense. The Ku Klux Klan appropriated the Confederate flag years ago, and the Confederate flag became a symbol of racial hatred and violence. And to try to say at this point in time that the flag means anything different is absurd. And so one of the things is that that whole controversy that surrounds Confederate image in this campus means that it's going to be difficult to recruit black students, for one reason. Another reason that it's going to be extremely difficult to recruit black students to a campus like this, and there are some publications that I've seen that indicate this, in fact I was reading an article not long ago, is that good black students follow black faculty. And certainly black students, and even more particularly black parents, are hopeful that there are going to be good black role models in place. I had hoped when I came back here last year to join Jarvis Hall, who was an assistant professor of politics, who had been here for 4 or 5 years. I get back last summer to find that Jarvis has resigned and that I'm going to be the only one in the college. Of course, there's Stephen Hobbs in the law school. But certainly, you're not going to easily attract enthusiastic and good black students where you don't have good black role models in place. Black students want to see black professors in a classroom. So that's a problem also.
So why do you think we don't attract black faculty?
Well, for some of the same reasons that we don't get students, some of which that I haven't mentioned. One is the town. Black professionals like to be in communities where there are going to be a lot of other people like themselves. For instance, young black doctors are more likely to gravitate to cities because they're going to be able to find a professional community of their peers. They're going to be able to find other people who have the same experiences. Not necessarily that they want to make their friends along racial lines, but oftentimes racial lines provide some of the same experiences and means of sharing some of the same frustrations, etc. As far as the black professional community in Lexington is concerned, I mean, this is a touchy issue with black folks in town, and rightfully so, because they don't want to put themselves down. But the black professional community in Lexington is largely a retired community of school teachers. People who once taught in a public school system here and have since gone home to spend the rest of their lives living on their own time and enjoying life that they the way they want. So if you're after a young black PhD to come to Washington and live to teach, then it's like, well, what's the social life going to be like for me after I get there? And is the social life going to be such that it sustains the person's enthusiasm about the community? That's a real problem for the college. There are no black faculty members at VMI. They are essentially a none here. I mean, the only reason I'm here, well, I shouldn't say the only reason I'm here, but one of the main reasons I'm here is because this is my hometown and I wanted to come back. I also wanted to come back because this is a better job than the one that I had in New York. I do have a real bond being with this university. I like, to some extent, living in a small town. Stephen Hobbs is here because he likes a small town and thinks it's an ideal place to raise children and is originally from a small town himself. But there is some frustration. I miss Jarvis Hall tremendously. We overlapped when I was here on a teaching fellowship. Washington and Lee oftentimes cites the reason for no black faculty as the reason I've just expressed, the difficulty of attracting people to a community like this. Same is true with students. In fact, there are a lot of white students who aren't going to come to Lexington because they want a social life beyond the campus, and a small town isn't going to offer the social life beyond the campus. So there's a lot of stuff that just sort of is self-perpetuating. Another thing with the recruitment of students that's a tremendous problem for us, and I'm sure the admissions office is very sensitive to this, is the kind of black students that Washington Lee certainly deserves and certainly would like to have, they have to compete with fairly prestigious places to get those students. And when the name of the game is competing with places, say, like an Ivy for a black student who is really good, and that black student also looking at prestige, and saying, well, you know, Washington Lee's a good school, but, you know, what's a degree from Princeton going to do for me? And then Washington Lee has a very, very difficult time in a situation like that. But I'm also critical of the college, because I think that the college, sometimes I feel is a little too content with those answers.
They come very quickly.
They come very quickly, and the other thing that I saw is what we did when we decided to be co-educational. I mean, there was a very concentrated effort to, even before co-education, to recruit female faculty. I don't think that the effort to recruit black faculty compares with the effort to recruit female faculty. I don't think that the effort to recruit black students compares with the effort to recruit female students. I am delighted that I have women colleagues. Some of my favorite colleagues are the women who are on this campus. I am delighted that I have female students. But I'm also troubled that we just celebrated the 10th anniversary of coeducation and the 30th anniversary of the arrival of black students passed unnoticed. When I left here, I was here on this graduate fellowship, which is a way the college attempts to bring blacks to the campus as well. I was here for 2 years on an ABD fellowship. And during the 2 years that I was here, we had 53 black students. I come back this year, we had 35 black students. And so I think that there's a real problem with recruitment. I think that oftentimes also I'm a little troubled sometimes about the ABD program as well.
I don't know what the ABD program is.
Well, several years ago, the college decided that
one of the ways that they could attract black faculty was to create this program by which you brought advanced graduate students to the campus to teach part-time while they wrote their dissertations. These people have taken their PhD comps, and the only thing they have to do is to write their dissertations. Washington and Lee gives them a fairly modest salary for a year's work, and it's renewable for 1 year. When I did it, $2,000 travel grant to do research, a lot of study in here, and you taught one class a semester for two semesters, and you had a third one off. And ideally, it's a good way to be able to do a little teaching while you're working on your dissertation. The problem, however, there's several problems with it. One is that I think that it also stigmatizes the people who are in the situation. It stigmatizes them because the students do not know that a great many of their esteemed professors who have PhDs, who are white, came here as ABDs many years ago when it wasn't important to have a PhD when you started. And so all of a sudden, you know, the only people that you have that are new on the campus who are teaching classes without a PhD are these black folks who are in a special program. And I worry about the stigmatization of black professionals. Well, you've got to give them this break in the ABD program in order for them to finish, and there are no white ABDs on the campus, and so this is a black thing. It becomes an affirmative action thing for sure. Now, certainly there are good things about the ABD program as well. The other thing that bothers me is that I think that oftentimes the ABD program serves as a means of pacifying the need to really actively recruit black professionals. And these ABD candidates, there's no tremendous investment in them. They're not on tenure track. They're here for a year. They can be renewed for a year. If they finish their PhDs, then it's possible that the department might consider to offer them a job, but it's then also possible that they won't be offered a job. And so this year we're going to have two on the campus. We're going to have one in geology and one in politics. And hopefully they will get their writing done, but I don't know. I'm putting you to sleep.
No, not at all.
So,
not at all.
Anyway.
No, I'm very, very interested in this.
But it cannot be an excuse for recruiting people who finished and people who will become a permanent part of the university.
I've been curious about you as a role model in that you went here. We have a lot of black graduates of Washington and Lee now who know exactly what Lexington is, who've gone out, and I presume some of them have pursued advanced degrees. Why aren't those people being looked at?
Well, I think one of the problems is what kind of advanced degrees. One of the things that any black PhD can tell you is that if you look at the graduate schools across the United States, that certainly you find black people in graduate schools, but the ones who are in PhD programs are very few. What people who are talented do is they go for the money, which is something blacks couldn't do 30 years ago. I mean, the vocations that were open to black people 30 years ago were limited, or 40 years ago. But if you go to the graduate schools anymore, you'll find that most of your blacks are going to be in the law school, are they might be working on MBAs, or they might be in medical school. But to find people who are going to teach at the college level, I mean, nobody's...
Are you that unique?
I don't think that I'm unique, but I think that I don't know of any other black Washington League graduate who has gone for a PhD. Mm-hmm. I know of lots of black Washington, I shouldn't say lots because they're not lots of us, but I know of other black Washington League graduates who've gotten law degrees. I even know of two who went to medical school. And I would be really very, very surprised if there was another black WNL PhD out there.
So I'm fantasizing about something that doesn't exist.
Yeah. In fact, I think that the number of Washington League graduates, period, who go to work on PhDs is probably much smaller, in spite of racial lines, it's much smaller than people who go to professional school. I think most of our people are probably headed for places like medical school, business school, and law school, and not to end up on the limited incomes that college professors have. So I think that there is no role model with regard to other black Washington Lee alumni, because my experience, certainly at William & Mary, was that talented black students did not want to teach. And of course, my experience at both William and Mary and at the State University of New York was that talented white students didn't want to teach. I mean, you know, they had this idea of making money, and you don't get rich teaching, so anyway.
That's discouraging and enlightening.
It's very sad to me. It's very sad.
You're a wonderful witness. I'm really glad to be talking with you. Another thing that I know has happened in recent years here was there was some controversy about some of the themes at Fancy Dress.
Yeah, I remember one of them, although I wasn't here when it happened. I read about one of them in Alumni Magazine, and I guess one of the themes was Reconciliation Ball, and I suppose was another way of glorifying the lost cause within the context of Fancy Dress. But I think one of the things that probably is more basic is the cultural differences that have emerged during the last 25 to 30 years that weren't there before. For instance, one of the things that sort of echoes the beginning of this interview is I talked about how wonderful it was growing up close by the fraternities, listening to the music. And when I look at the late 60s and even the early 70s, the music that the students enjoyed on this campus was largely black music. I mean, one of the sweethearts of the campus was Dionne Warwick, who the students brought here time and time again. I can remember some friends of mine who, after a concert, invited the Four Tops to their, the Four Tops to their apartment, got them to autograph their living room wall, okay? So there were people like the Temptations who were coming to Washington Lee's campus. Something happened during the psychedelic era where the music that was enjoyed by the two races veered in opposite directions. And I think that this has been more of a problem than fancy dress themes. You know, what you can do with regard to music, first of all, that is going to be acceptable to both races of students. And what I see now is that it's even worse. You know, I don't like my son's music, period, and I'm usually thankful that he's not a rap fan, because I don't think that's music at all, and I think that my generation of young blacks would have found it an abomination. I mean, compare Ice-T, for instance, to the Four Tops. I mean, there's no comparison at all. And I don't know, I think the music veering apart is way worse than the themes for Fancy Dress. The only theme that I remember that was controversial was the Reconciliation Ball. The other themes, I mean, I can remember one time it was New York. I mean, how could that be controversial? I mean, black students didn't choose New York as a theme. There are not enough of them to matter with regard to selection of a theme. One time, I think it was ancient Egypt. I mean, that's not going to offend black students. But I remember vividly black students being unhappy about the music. And one time, the university was even permitting sort of a parallel ball, where there would be this annual black ball, which would be the way of appeasing the black students, because then the black students were able to have the kind of music that they wanted for the black ball. But I think the cultural divide that has occurred was worse than anything. And I'm not sure how to explain that. And of course, when I was a student, it really didn't matter, because I was married, had a child, was president of the PTA, et cetera. And so, you know, I wasn't doing the kinds of things that students half
so
my age.
So you wouldn't have gone to Black Ball?
No. In the first place, I don't dance. And I went to Fancy Dress once, and that was enough for me, and I never wanted to go again. And that was before I became a student, and my wife and I went, and because I don't dance and never have been talented as far as dancing was concerned, I don't feel comfortable at stuff like that. And I've heard other people say that they don't like to go to Fancy Dress because they don't like to be around drunks. And I can't say that, because the time that I was there, I didn't notice anybody who was drunk. But the other thing is that I just don't want to be there, period. I enjoy music. And, you know, if I can sit there and listen, fine. But, you know, if I got to sit there and watch people dance and feel like an oddball because I'm not, then I don't think that's a lot of fun. So, but I think that students oftentimes blow things like that out of proportion. And when alumni sometimes get involved in those debates, I think it's inappropriate. I think alumni ought to keep their mouths shut and let the students attempt to work things like that out with the guidance of the appropriate people on the campus, and both the administration and the faculty. And I can remember that there were alumni who felt very strongly in the issue of the Reconciliation Ball, but I don't know. I'm not sure I think it's much of an issue.
All right, so you've come back. You're a full-fledged member of the faculty. What's it like now?
Well, it's interesting in many different respects. One of the things that I've really enjoyed is being welcomed back in by people who were both my mentors when I was a student, people who've been my friends for a number of years, and the students themselves. I mean, the students have been really nice to me, and unlike other black alumni, you know, I don't have the bad experiences of students up close, and I need to explain how I learned later, how I learned about bad experiences that black students did have. I wonder, however, if after I finish this, I can excuse myself long enough to tell my son that I'm not going to take lunch at 12 unless you want to take lunch at 12 or something.
Do you want to take a pause now?
Yeah,
okay.
If we could.
All right, so You were saying how you knew there were problems?
I thought we were on what it's like being a...
Now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You seem to sort of be going two ways, and I'm not sure which way you were going.
One of the ways that I was going was what it was like to be back on the faculty, mm-hmm. but I was also saying that later in the interview, I need to reflect on how I knew that there were problems among the students. One of the things about being back on the faculty, being back here and on the faculty, is that I really love teaching. And, you know, my wife used to tell me during the early years of our marriage that, you know, I probably would be very good at teaching, and it was my wife who pushed me to finally become a full-time student. And that was something we didn't talk about either, was what it was like to be an adult student at Washington Lee.
Oh, I've got a note there that I want to get back to that.
But one of the things that I really enjoy my teaching here. Now, the acceptance by the faculty has been overwhelming. For instance, I got nominated for a couple of faculty committees this year, and the first one I got nominated for was the Faculty Executive Committee. And somebody told me after the meeting, I think I'd gotten something like 35 votes or something. And somebody told me after the meeting that I had been elected by more votes than any faculty member had been elected to a meeting in years. And I was like, well, 35 isn't even half the faculty. I mean, well, apparently there was, the 35 votes meant there was just extraordinary enthusiasm for me being on the faculty executive committee. And so I was sort of flattered with the things people were seeing. And then, I guess it was at the next meeting, I got elected to the Student Affairs Committee, and the vote for the Student Affairs Committee was 55. And so it was like, and there was this warm applause by the faculty. And so, you know, I certainly am humbled by and feel very grateful by the vote of confidence from the faculty, and many of these people have known me for years, and a lot of the new people are just getting to know me, and I'm just getting to know them. So, you know, certainly there's that side of it. The other side of it is that it's kind of fun at my age to have a new challenge. I mean, I had an alumnus that I got pretty angry with, and I used to get angry with him when he was a student, who said to me, I heard what you'd done, but aren't you awfully old to be an assistant professor? I mean, that's the other side of what happened the other day in the health food store. But in any case, you know, I was awfully old to be an undergraduate, too. But what I find is that I am thrust into a situation where the stakes are higher than they were for many of my colleagues. For instance, I'm expected to publish as a part of getting tenure, and that was not true 20 years ago when many of my friends came to Washington and Lee to teach. I'm also, because of that, forced to spend my summers doing research and scholarly activity rather than planning my courses for the fall, or rather than teaching in summer programs, or rather than gardening. And I'm having a good time with it. You know, one of the things that's incredibly fun to me is that, you know, my PhD has 1995 on it. And already I've got a contract with the University Press of Kentucky to publish the dissertation. And so, you know, I'm 52 years old and I'm doing things that I probably would have enjoyed doing 30 years ago, but 30 years ago was not the time it was meant for me to do those things. I love my students. Generally, the feedback I get from my students is positive. I look at the evaluations that my students fill out, and I find myself both humbled and flattered by the evaluations. I also find myself both humbled and flattered by the communications, the summer communications by the students. For instance, one of my students is Sandy Hooper, who will be the president of the student body this year. Sandy's up at Middlebury. I've had email from Sandy from Middlebury College. I have good experiences in New York with my students, even though many of the bad experiences in New York sort of stand out in my head because it was a little, students were not particularly well-mannered or not always well-behaved in class up there, which was very different from Washington and Lee. But the one thing is that being back here is very important to me. It's one of the things that troubles me probably is that I don't have much of an impact on black students, and I think that's partly because of where I am in space and time and where some of them are in space and time. One of the things is that I don't get a lot of black students in my classes. I'm not sure why.
Are they taking history?
Yeah, some of them are. When I was here before, I had a black student to tell me that the reason he hadn't taken any of my classes were because they were too much work, which sort of a sad revelation. I will never cut down on the amount of work that I assign in order to attract students, no matter what their race may be. The other thing is that, you know, I had a black student to say to me this year, and I was really troubled by this, that he had found my introductory U.S. history class completely demoralizing. And when I asked him why, and he said, well, his great talent was when he was discussing issues of race. And I said, well, you know, this is introductory United States history. It's not a class in race and ethnic relations. And it's the wrong class if you think that every class is going to be a forum on racial matters, because it can't be. We've got to cover a whole range of things from such and such a date to such and such a date. And the thing that also distressed me about the criticism was that we had two paperbacks in my class for that particular semester were W.E.B. Du Bois's The Souls of Black Folk and a wonderful little paperback, the last name of the author is Miles, but the name of it's Lunch at the 5 and 10. It was about desegregation lunch counters in Greensboro, North Carolina. And I vividly remember it, and I keep careful records, that he had cut that class. And when we were discussing Lunch at the 5 and 10, and there was his opportunity to talk about race, and it wasn't my fault that he didn't get that opportunity, it was his own. And so I guess at this point in my life, I sort of think that one of the things that black students have got to do is that they've also got to be very realistic. A course in United States history is not a course about race. Certainly race is going to be one of many factors, as well as gender. But there are lots of other things that I have to do in a course in introductory United States history, too. I'm teaching for the first time in Washington, at least. It's not exactly the first time in Washington. Holt Merchant has taught a spring term course that has been called Seminar in African American History. But I'm teaching a two-semester course this year in African American history at the 300 level. Certainly the first time African American history has been taught at the upper level. There are 8 students pre-registered for that class at this date, which has space for 25, and to my knowledge, not a single one of those students is black. So, I'd love to have black students in there. I would love to have black students study with me. But I'm not going to assign less material in the case of the one student who told me that my classes entail too much work in order to attract anyone. And the other thing that I'm not going to do is I'm not going to pander to bad scholarship. And the one thing that I think that is true of a lot of the Afrocentric scholarship, a lot of it's good and very important, but a lot of it is bad. A lot of it is not scholarly at all, and I'm not going to do that. And so I realize that there are going to be black students also who are going to view me as a conservative sellout because I'm not going to participate in scholarship that I do not think is quality scholarship. And many of the Afrocentric claims, there's no evidence to prove. And I'm not going to do that. And so, you know, I don't know what the situations are, but if students want to come, they're free to exchange ideas. And I'm never, ever going to grade anybody down because their opinions differ from mine. But the one thing that I am going to require is that all students, no matter what their race is, work hard and do the very best job as possible. And so.
Need change tapes.